I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Researcher Susan Sorensen has been studying the non-fatal use of guns during acts of domestic violence and found that 4.5 million women in this country have been threatened or coerced with a firearm, and 1 million women have survived a gunshot wound or have been shot at by an intimate partner. Even the presence of a gun in a household can be used to control a woman's behavior. Radio Times producer Debbie Bilder spoke with Sorensen about her findings. She's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania.
Guns are used to intimidate. Guns are used to coerce behaviors from women. They can be used in very concrete ways to explain. They can pistol whip the woman. They can be used to shoot or shoot at her. And also simply to threaten her, to have a hostile display of a gun, mm-hmm. to brandish a weapon. A woman will often acquiesce in contexts like that.
Well, it's this very lethal. I mean, in a moment, the abuser could kill the person. I can imagine that there's very little the victim could do.
Exactly. And if a woman is faced with someone who's trying to hit her, either with her own hands or fists or with an object, she might choose to fight back and get injured in the context of that self-defense. But with a gun, she makes a different judgment. And says, okay, is there another way we can settle this?
And this is something, I guess, in the field that you call coercive control.
Yes, coercive control is typically identified and defined as a way to control, to denigrate, to coerce and intimidate somebody. So that creates an environment, an ongoing context in the relationship of intense fear. All I have to do is display a gun once. In the context of an argument, you don't have to use it. You don't have to fire it or use it to beat someone. But you're in the middle of an argument and you just take out a gun, put it on the table. A woman is going to back off from that.
Right. And in your article, you even say glancing in the direction of a gun or where a gun is kept could also have that same effect.
Absolutely.
One of the points of this recent review that you've done in the Journal of Trauma, Violence, and Abuse is coming up with a number, trying to really get a grasp of the scope of this problem. How many women do we think have been threatened, have been coerced with guns, even if they haven't been fired?
The most recent estimate that we have of non-fatal gun use comes from the late 1990s. So it's almost 20 years ago now. And if that estimate holds true today, there are about 4.5 million women in the United States alive today who have been threatened by an intimate partner violence holding a gun. Mm-hmm. It's hard to make sense of a number like that. And so I was thinking recently, it's like New York City, it's about 9 million people. About half of those are women and or girls. And so if you look at every single woman and girl in New York City, they represent the number of women who have been coerced with a gun in the United States.
So what kind of psychological impact does that have on women who've been survivors of abuse, who've had sort of this coercive control from a gun in their lives?
There's a long-term psychological impact of intimidation, of being very careful, because it basically crushes any will that a woman might have to leave a relationship or to become more independent in some way. And we know from previous research that women are most likely to be murdered when the relationship is ending, or when she's trying to leave the relationship, when she's doing exactly what society tells her to do, which mm-hmm. is to leave the abuser.
Mm-hmm. I have to ask, are we usually talking about women and men as the abusers, especially around gun violence or this non-fatal use of guns? Is it most often men as the abuser?
Most often, yes. And it's particularly around the gun stuff, because men are more likely to own guns mm-hmm. than women. I'm doing some research here with the Philadelphia Police Department on non-fatal gun use and intimate partner violence. And about 85% of those non-fatal gun uses are against women.
So what options do women have who are abused and there's a gun in the house and it's been used in this way of coercive control? Can they call the police and will the police take action?
Women can definitely call the police. And another thing they can do is file for a restraining order, which is known here in Pennsylvania as a protection from abuse order. Mm-hmm. And some people say, oh, it's just a piece of paper, and that's not going to stop anything. Well, that piece of paper does two things. One is it tells law enforcement that I'm really serious about wanting this to end. I don't want this violence to continue. And police, rightly or wrongly, tend to take the violence more seriously when there is a restraining order in place, because that in and of itself is another violation of law. Also, another thing that's important with a protection from abuse order is that it puts the person to be restrained on a list that is used when you check for background checks for purchasing a gun. So people who have a protection from abuse order are not supposed to be able to legally purchase or possess a firearm.
So that's tracked nationally?
It's tracked nationally. It's also tracked on the state level. Mm-hmm. States differ in how they do their background checks. But that's a federal law. It was passed in 1994 with the Violence Against Women Act. And then 2 years later with the Lautenberg Amendment, it added those who are convicted of a domestic violence misdemeanor.
And when we're talking about treating women who've suffered abuse, is it important to know that they have been involved in this kind of course of control? Does that affect the kind of therapy, the kind of treatment they get? And is that different than, say, somebody who's been physically abused in a different way?
I think it'd be helpful for service providers and clinicians to better understand the person who's in front of them if they know that she has been subject to non-fatal gun use, because it doesn't leave marks. It's typically not associated with injury. And so they would have a better understanding of sort of her psychological makeup at this point, because you're going to accommodate to living in this kind of fear after a while. And so to get back to health again, it'll take maybe something a little different.
Clearly, guns and domestic violence are really closely tied together. Are there other laws we should be looking at? Are there other regulations we should be looking at to try to keep guns out of the hands of abusers?
There's talk fairly regularly about the possibility of having smart guns, which are personalized weapons mm-hmm. that are used only by the authorized user. And if you have a weapon like that, which I think it will be only a matter of time before they actually are brought fully to the market in the United States, we need to think about what is the impact for women's lives and for coercive control if the abuser is the only one who can use that weapon.
Well, that raises the question of, is a woman or is somebody who's abused safer if they purchase a gun, if they have a gun to defend themselves?
What we know so far, the answer is no. And in fact, there has been research that's been done that tracked women who purchased a handgun and then followed up to see about their risk of being killed. And women were twice as likely to be killed by an intimate partner if they had purchased a gun than if they hadn't purchased a gun. Hmm. They were not at higher risk of being killed by an acquaintance, a family member, or anyone else. So it was specific to intimate partners. So the primary reason for purchasing a gun, particularly a handgun, is self-protection. And it looks like that is not the case for women when it comes to intimate partners.
Susan Sorensen, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times.
I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thank you.
That was University of Pennsylvania researcher and professor Susan Sorensen talking with Radio Times producer Debbie Bilder. We're discussing domestic violence today, including the non-fatal use of firearms, the lasting physical and psychological impact. And joining us is Renee Norris-Jones, a domestic abuse survivor, also an advocate and board member of Women Against Abuse. And Renee, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. I was watching very carefully as you were listening to Debbie's interview there, and I know at one point in your violent marriage, your husband put a gun to your head while you were in bed together. Had he ever done that before?
No, and it was my first exposure to any kind of a gun in my life. And it was towards the end, and I had already made plans to leave again. And he probably picked up on that. And we all know that the most dangerous time for a woman is when she's leaving. And as we got in bed, he brought out this gun, put it to my temple, put his finger on the trigger, and put a pillow on top of it. And the pillow was to keep it from moving, or I guess in his mind, going off while I was sleeping, but it was to make sure that I did not slip out again. And I slept like that for about 4 or 5 nights. I don't remember how long. And I'm listening to the interview, and it changed my whole plan. Like, I had a new job starting in a couple of months. Everything was all set. And I definitely had to get out of there sooner. But that was frightening, and I found out later that the gun didn't have a safety on it. But his finger was on the gun with a pillow on it to keep it from moving, and that was chilling. It's still chilling now.
Oh, it's chilling to even imagine that, even imagine trying to sleep under those conditions. But was this for you, and we'll talk more about your marriage, but was this for you the last straw, in a sense that if I don't get out of here, I could die?
I was already at the last straw, and this was pretty much in the seventh year, but I knew to be strategic. So I had a job that was already planned in 3 months. I had a lease that I had signed on the other side of town, everything, school. But when that came home, I had to change gears quickly, because at that point, I didn't sleep. I was just sitting there. I was afraid to move, to blink, to turn over, because this gun is pressing against my temple as he's sleeping. If he made the wrong move or something, it was just it's time to go. Mm. It's absolutely time to get out now. Screw the plan. Let's just go.
And how quickly after that did you leave?
How long did it take? I want to say it probably was 2 or 3 days. I called a friend of mine who was going to be my new roommate. I called her, and she was like, oh, my God, we've got to get out of there. She said, what are you doing? I said, I'm not sleeping. I'm just sitting up. And we quickly changed our lease, and I was out of there. I want to say within a week.
Were there guns in the house?
No, that was my first exposure to any kind of a gun. Any kind of a weapon, it was always with his fists, with his feet. It was always everything else, but there was never a weapon in the house.
And did a weapon feel more potentially lethal than fists?
I had never been around a gun before, besides television. The fact that it wasn't even like on the table. It was against my temple, and I just knew it's your panic mode, you know, panic mode. I have to do something. And normally when I leave, I only took my stuff because it was about me. It wasn't about cutting his stuff or throwing his stuff. I would move his stuff, take my stuff. And in that instance, I did talk to my roommate, and I said, we've got to take this gun. And she said, I thought you said you never take his stuff. You never take his stuff. I said, this is Texas. he is going to have to go out. He's going to be furious when he finds out when he comes home that I'm gone. He's going to have to go out in the middle of the night, find a gun. At least this will make him wait a couple of hours until the morning. So we picked it up carefully, put it in a shoebox, and we left.
We have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about domestic violence in this hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about domestic violence in this hour, including the use of non-fatal use of firearms in domestic violence. And let me quickly reintroduce our three guests. I was just talking with Renee Norris-Jones. She's a domestic abuse survivor. She's an advocate, a board member of Women Against Abuse. Also with us is Janine Lisitsky, and she's executive director of Women Against Abuse. Janine, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And also with us is Lieutenant Crystal Dahl Campbell. She's a lieutenant with the Victim Services Unit and Community Relations for the Philadelphia Police Department. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Renee, I do feel the need to go back to you because we sort of started with the end of your story. You were in a 7-year marriage.
I was in a 7-year marriage, yes.
That you have described as public and private abuse.
Absolutely.
Beatings.
Absolutely.
Psychological.
And this was in the 70s. Yeah, psychological. I am still in therapy. And the more I'm in therapy and the more I do this kind of work, and I love doing this kind of work, the more I'm learning how it still impacts my life almost 40 years later. I think I noticed it was there, and by speaking and talking about it, getting the training through Women Against Abuse, by being an advocate, learning more about myself, and still adjusting in how I present. Like a lot of times I would say, I just got out of a 13-year relationship, no violence, but folks would say, well, how does it impact you? I said, well, yeah. I'm in a 10-year relationship, and I still look and say, what did you bring me coffee for? I wanted tea. Because I'm ever vigilant. I live in that space. So my therapist is trying to get me to not be as vigilant because I live in that never again. So the trauma has definitely colored my life. And I've met other survivors who have said, nope, since that happened 40 years ago or 30 years ago, I've not been in a relationship again.
Because you don't trust.
You don't trust.
The partner. Maybe you don't trust yourself.
Not myself. Not myself. It's the betrayal that goes with that. It's the psychological. I've always described myself as a prisoner of war.
That's what it felt like?
That's what it felt like. If my husband at the time said, you didn't eat, you didn't smoke, you didn't do this, you didn't do it. You didn't do it. My a year and a half, I have to jump forward a little bit, a year and a half after we were divorced, my ex-husband at that time bludgeoned his mother to death with an axe. Wow. And my first thought, and I still get chills thinking about it, was, that could have been me.
Yeah.
And I was not shocked. It was, yep, that's pretty much what my life was like. I can totally relate to that. And it definitely informs me today. So continued therapy this much longer helps me to stay focused. It helps me to recognize when I need to do self-care. And Women Against Abuse advocates for that, you know, all the time, doing self-care and knowing when I need to step back.
Janine, let me get you in on the conversation. I also want to get you in, Krista, as well. And one of the things that Susan Sorensen talked about was coercive control, the idea of having a gun either in the house, even in a closet somewhere, just knowing that there's a gun in a house is a form of coercive control. As someone who works with women and probably some men as well, how do you see that the influence, the power of that coercive control?
You know, the idea of coercive control is very important to understanding domestic violence. A lot of people falsely think of it as hitting between two people. But what we know is that there can be shoving and hitting, and we wouldn't consider that domestic violence, because what domestic violence is a pattern of behaviors, coercive behaviors, in order to gain control. So maybe it's not physical. You know, it could be financial, sexual, emotional, psychological, but it's all of these things, and it's cumulative. And it's tactics such as isolating the victim from their family, their friends, putting them down, belittling them. So it's an attack on all fronts. And imagine that, and then there's a gun in the home.
Sure.
You know, it's very powerful. Maybe the perpetrator has only pushed them once, but all the other things cumulatively paralyze people in fear, oftentimes.
And Susan Sorensen talks about the will. I mean, sort of crushing the will, which, of course, is so essential to being a human being, to have this will, the spirit.
It's, you know, foundational. They're crushing the foundation of all a person can be. It's really oppression. And when we see people come out and what their lives are like, truly we can describe it as freedom. So, I mean, they were in some heavy oppression and a very dangerous situation.
Yeah. I mean, Renee used the word prisoner.
Yeah, exactly. And to piggyback off of that, the number one question that I get as a survivor, and I've been out for almost 40 years, is why did you stay? Why did you stay? And it takes a lot. It takes opportunity and courage to be able to leave. And when I went through it, I mean, today in Philadelphia, we have 200 beds, and that's still not enough. But when I went through it, there might have been less than 15. So it takes that opportunity. Back then, it was a payphone, to slip out, to make that phone call, and to hear there's no room.
Yeah.
Or to hear we can put you up at the Salvation Army or someplace else for one night.
Then what?
Right? And right, where am I going tomorrow? And to hear that, now you have to slip back in. Hopefully he didn't discover that you left. So with that, the next time the courage and the opportunity comes, it took so much to get up that, to get that up to say, I'm going to do this, I'm going to leave, and to know that you, there's no space, and going through that time and time again. And a lot of times you don't have family support. I did not have family support. You go, you know what? I'll just stay here. And change, whether it's a new job or coming out of school, we all are paralyzed sometimes by fear. So sometimes you go, you know what? I'm just going to stay, because at least I know at 5:02 every Wednesday, he's going to come in and beat the crap out of me. Because fear can be paralyzing.
Yeah.
Very paralyzing.
Krista, let me get you in on the conversation. And I'm interested in this coercive control idea. And as we heard from Susan Sorensen, it doesn't leave marks. It's a more psychological control. And I wonder, right, as how the police department, even answering a call, let's say, how you assess a situation.
Well, we're trained to look at more than just the physical marks on a complainant or a victim. You have to assess the whole situation, the whole scene. We have changed our forms specifically for domestic violence incidents, where you utilize a 48D, which for us is the paperwork that is exclusively for domestic violence. So we want to look and see how many times have officers been out to that house. What were the prior instances? What were the prior complaints? So you can see the totality of the situation, as well as what does the home look like? And what is the complainant telling us happened today? Can we verify it? So we're looking at more than just that moment in time. Also, to go off of what Renee was saying, I think officers have been trained, as well as all society, but specifically officers, that, you know, in the past, I think it was, why doesn't she leave?
Right.
Whereas now we understand that each time we go, that could be the moment that we can help change and help them get to where they need to be. It may not be the first time or the fifth time. It might be the 11th time. But that moment could be the time that we can help you move forward and get out of that situation.
Is the idea to calm the situation, to figure out what happened? Is it to arrest someone because they have been threatening somebody?
Well, the idea is to assess each situation for what it is, and to do our best to find out what took place in that moment. And then, yes, absolutely, if the incident calls for an arrest, to make one.
And a protection from abuse order, that's what happens in Philadelphia if it's gone that far?
Well, we always advise to complainants, whether it was an arrestable offense or not, if they're having ongoing domestic violence incidents in their home, that to feel safe and to make a progressive step forward to get a protection from abuse order to protect themselves and other members of their family. And those orders can come with or without eviction. And then we can help serve those orders and then carry out and make sure that they're enforced.
What we've been hearing, Janine, is that when someone is leaving a violent domestic situation, that that's often a point at which the abuser can act against that person, even in a more violent way, including killing them.
That is.
And we certainly have heard incidents of that.
Absolutely. And it goes along with the whole theory about domestic violence that undergirds it, is that coercive control. So if a person is leaving, the perpetrator is losing control, right, and sees that. And that's when they take more extreme steps in order to try to gain that control back. So it fits in with the pattern that we see throughout domestic violence.
And Renee, you were describing the situation. You were in Texas at the time.
Yes.
So how did you get away from your husband at that point?
I left when he wasn't there. And I frequently talk about this. And a couple of minutes ago, the conversation came up where sometimes a woman, when they call the police, that might be the time it takes, on average, 7 times for a woman to leave. And what I ask people, what I remind people of, is just because someone does something bad to you, whether it's cheating or they become an alcoholic or they become violent, doesn't mean that we can just turn our love off. So you're very conflicted and you're feeling betrayed because this was to death do us part. And so there's a lot of, and then the abuser will come back with, it's never going to happen again. It's never going to happen again. I mean, you have this whole script that's almost textbook.
Was that true
yes.
with your husband?
Yes. The flowers, it's never going to happen again. I'm going to go get help. in 1999, my sister was killed in murder-suicide. She was actually out. She was staying in a shelter. Women Against Abuse in Philadelphia was full, so she was staying in one of the county shelters. And my father had called and said, you know, they were in charge. Her, my sister and her husband were in charge of getting our family home ready for the next rental. And she said, I'm in a shelter. And he said, you guys don't need to be over here. Your husband and wife, you need to be over here. And they were in the house. My dad was there. They went to the basement. Within 2 minutes, my father heard a gunshot. Wow. By the time he got up and ran to the top of the basement steps, my sister's husband came up, looked at my father, and he put the gun in his own mouth and shot himself.
Oh, goodness.
So that was, it was, for me, it was more trauma to know that this is happening, and it just made me more determined to make sure that I'm telling my story. And I remember the first time that I acknowledged publicly that I'm a victim. It's so liberating because there's so much shame that comes with it. It's so much shame. And then I say now that I share my story for three reasons. One is for my own healing, my own healing journey. It's to offer education because there's so much misinformation out there with society, and to hold out hope for victims of domestic violence. I'd sometimes wonder what that would have been for me to have someone stand up and say, hey, I survived. You can do it too. So I think it's powerful for victims to know that they can make it.
Well, and it's so interesting to use the word victim and then to use the word survivor.
Yes.
I mean, those are two very different words.
Yes. Yes. So I am a survivor of domestic violence, and, mm-hmm. and I stand on that. And as a victim, you're in it. And I know that there's been some conversation about calling everyone victim on the national level. Is that correct, Janine?
You know, it depends. An actual survivor may not want to be called a survivor, may want to be called a victim.
Yes.
You know, so it's kind of used interchangeably
yes.
at times
yes.
Now. But, you know, I just want to add to what you said about hope.
Yes.
That here in Philadelphia, we are very fortunate to have a 24/7 hotline, the Philadelphia Domestic Violence Hotline.
Absolutely.
Which is a lifeline, and people can call anytime. It can be anonymous, even family of people, professionals, police call that line to get support. And that number is 1-866-723-3014. That line can also connect you with Safe Haven, legal services, and other resources needed to find a way out. And even if you're not looking to get out, but you want to plan, you want to talk, that can happen too on that line.
We're focusing largely on Philadelphia, but I wonder, Janine, the stats on just domestic violence itself. And I want to make sure that yes, women can be the victim. I think it's 1 in 3. I was also reading for men, it's 1 in 4. So we're talking about potentially a significant number of people who are at risk for some form of violence by an intimate partner.
That's correct. And, you know, the data, that research goes more on physical abuse. So we have to ask ourselves, is there a pattern of coercive control? And, you know, what we see is that, say, through our hotline calls, that 85% are female or identified as women, because we also serve LGBTQ trans individuals. So, you know, that's our experience.
Sure, sure. I'm thinking about guns, and as we know, Chris, I mean, there are just so many guns in this country, and certainly yes. Philadelphia is a problem of illegal guns as well. And we heard that, at least by if you get on a list, a protective abuse order list, mm-hmm. you can not be denied access to guns. How does that work?
Well, when you get a protection from abuse order filed against you, your name is entered into a system. And for us, it goes through the state police. And when the person would go to apply for a weapon, they would run a background check. And when that would come up, they would then be ineligible. So it certainly is a good tool for women to have, and men who are victims of this type of behavior, to get a protection from abuse order to protect themselves.
What kind of training does the police have if they're part of your unit?
What do you need to know?
Well, for my unit, we're basically a support mechanism for all victim assistance officers. Every district in the city has a victim assistance officer known as a VAO, and we're a support mechanism for them. So we make sure we stay up to date on trainings on various topics and certainly on domestic violence. But patrol in general, which is all the officers on the street, also receive training, and they are trained in all different types of topics, and domestic violence is a key area that they're trained in the academy. And then also we have municipal police officer training every year. And it usually touches base at some point, at least with domestic violence, because it is something that happens frequently. And also it's
frequently.
Yes. And it's also a dangerous situation for officers. So we have to make sure that our officers are prepared for those scenarios and don't get complacent.
Why is it dangerous for officers?
Well, it's a highly volatile situation, as we talked about earlier, with a defendant or an offender, rather, losing control of a situation, and us arriving can feel like that loss of control. And we're like a physical and visual idea of that issue for them. So it can be a very dangerous situation for officers to walk in on. And so we always make sure that officers are aware to, you know, remain safe and know their training, while also being sensitive and caring for the victim involved in the incident.
We're almost up on a break here, but the idea that the person with the gun could then turn that gun on the police officers coming to the door?
Absolutely. We have time and time again seen officers injured and killed in domestic violence situations just for arriving on location as that threatening presence has the office. That's how the offender views us.
Well, let's take that short break and we'll get back to our conversation talking about domestic violence, what we know about it, what we're learning about it, what we need to know about it. That's Lieutenant Krista Dahl-Campbell, Lieutenant for the Victim Services Unit and Community Relations for the Philadelphia Police Department. Renee Norris-Jones has been telling us her story. She's a domestic abuse survivor. She's an advocate, a board member of Women Against Abuse. And also with us is Janine Lisiski, and she's the executive director of Women Against Abuse, and that's a nonprofit, a domestic violence advocate and service provider here in Philadelphia. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we are talking about domestic violence. We were also talking during the break, and Janine, you mentioned the fact that, the police department gets 100,000 calls a year.
Correct.
That's correct.
And those are 100,000 domestic in nature. So then from that, it'll be a smaller pool that ultimately are, you know, bona fide domestic violence, or that they can find DV. Because a lot of times they'll show up and they don't see anything.
Right.
So then it gets dropped. But, you know, that is staggering considering we have 1.6 million in Philly. So 100,000. And that's only the people we know of. Not everyone will reach out to the police. So we have really had a push over the last handful of years to create a citywide effort, not only in law enforcement, but in health and human services, which includes the homeless system, child welfare, behavioral health, the health department, all of screening and intervening earlier, because it shouldn't just be that the police are the only response, or, you know, Women Against Abuse and other domestic violence organizations when the victim reaches out. You know, we need to be proactive and prevent and serve people better, because if they're not being served in these systems, literally they are recidivating back into the homeless system because of domestic violence, and it's never addressed.
And I'm also thinking about the children. And I know, Renee, for you, you made the obviously very difficult decision of putting your children up for adoption.
I did. I could not protect my children. And my family was not there to protect them. I am the youngest girl of seven children. It was six girls and one boy. And my father was my hero. He was my hero. I was daddy's little girl. And I remember showing up at his doorstep one day. You know, black eyes, had a fractured cheekbone, my nose was, you know, I was a mess. And he looked at me and he said, "What did you think marriage was?"
Wow.
My family would send me back. You go back to your husband. That's where you, a wife stays with her husband. So with that in society, It warms my heart just to hear the conversation today because it reminds me how far it's come. Right. The work that I do, the volunteer work that I do with Women Against Abuse, it's healing for me to know all of the steps that that we're taking, our citywide initiatives, make sure that the goal is so that no matter where a woman shows up in the system, that she's going to get the same level of care. And that's so very important. And in empowering women, women reach out to me. Anyone that knows me knows someone that knows me. If someone's being victimized, I get a phone call, and I will listen as a survivor. But I'm telling you to call that number. A lot of times, the hotline numbers, folks say, "Well, I know someone. It's my neighbor. It's someone I ride the bus with. I'm commute with." Call that number. Mm-hmm. Call that number because there are some things that you don't want to say. And it took me going through the training in recent years to realize, that's right, Women Against Abuse never told me to leave. They never told me not to go back. If I decided to go back, the conversation was, okay, well, let's do some safety planning. It was all about empowering me. And that's what it's about. So it's important for folks, if you know someone, call that hotline number. They're there to help you, give you some language, give you the do's and don'ts of what not to say. That can further bring that woman down. Mm. The batter, whoever it is already working on that. So we have to uplift her. And sometimes it's the opposite of what you think you want to do that should be done. So that hotline number is for anybody. As Janine said, you can just call. You can call anonymous. You can call and say, is my relationship healthy? I've been hearing about this domestic violence. Is my relationship healthy?
1-866-723-3014, 24/7.
Yes.
I mean, I'm thinking from your own story, Renee, and I'm sure this is true for a lot of people under these similar situations, is just feeling alone.
Yes.
I mean, as you talked about the shame, if you're shameful about something, you generally don't talk about it.
Yes. Yes, and it's something to have, to be able to say, my spouse, my husband, my boyfriend, this person, the father of my children, is abusing me. They're dehumanizing me. It takes a lot to say that.
Yeah,
it takes a lot to admit it to yourself that this is going on. There's a lot of, I mean, you're in shock. I remember the first time it happened to me. It was a year and a half in. And folks said, did you see signs? I'm not sure if I would see signs now, maybe because I'm so hyper-vigilant, but it was a Friday date night. We were getting ready to get out. I was finishing up makeup in the mirror. He was sitting on the side of the bed and was like, are we going to do Italian for dinner? I had that for lunch, maybe Mexican. And it was just this easy conversation. And I woke up on the floor.
Because he punched you out?
Knocked me out. I literally woke up. I'd never been knocked out before and never seen violence in my own home. So it was a shock. Mm. So it's Janine said, it's this pattern. It's something that's building. It's not something that you meet someone and on the second date they strike you. There's no emotional attachment there. So it's something that they're building your trust. They're kind of building you up, and at the same time they're isolating you.
Yeah. Let me read. We have a bunch of comments here. Question from Kevin. Are there signs that we can look for before getting involved with a potential abuser? Are abusers attracted to partners who are vulnerable, having no siblings, no family? Can you answer that, Janine?
It's an equal opportunity crime. So I don't think there's a certain type of survivor, you know, that gets drawn in. And what it is, you want to look for things like if there's fast involvement, you know, a person wants to get very involved quickly, then wants to start saying, oh, I want to spend a lot of time with you. Don't go out with your friends. Don't go to your family because I really want to be with you. Things like that. Jealousy, wanting to monitor where you're going, what you're doing, that type of thing.
You want to add to that, Krista?
Well, certainly. I think when you say an equal opportunity crime, I think that's very true. I mean, there's different types of crime that happen in different districts, but universally you're going to have domestic violence, regardless what district you live in, what zip code, what income level you have. It's certainly an all-encompassing crime.
Yeah.
So, and I think, the control is very important. If you notice right away that someone is very controlling, even if it seems initially as maybe being interested or sweet, it's something to pay attention to.
The fact that they sort of want you all the time.
Sure.
The way they want you. Yeah.
And it crosses every social, economic, racial, cultural line.
Let me see what Jimmy from Clifton Heights has to say. Hi, Jimmy. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
You've all said what happens. You've all said that authorities are notified when someone gets a protective order.
Right.
But what happens to the gun? What happens to the gun in a household when someone gets that order?
Oh, sure. Fair enough. Krista, go ahead.
Well, if the Philadelphia Police Department serves the order, it could be served by the Sheriff Department as well. But when we serve the order, we look to see if the guns are listed and also if the complainant knows where the guns are. And if the order specifies, we take the guns from the home and we put them on a property receipt. They're taken down to
the police department holds on to the guns?
Correct. It goes to our FIU, firearms unit, and we put them on a property receipt, and they go as part of the protection order.
Gotcha. Jimmy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. A comment from Anonymous. I'm a domestic violence survivor. I've tried to get Pennsylvania police to investigate, but it was difficult. New Jersey police was much better. Now, we don't know the details here, but can you say, Krista, that police are taking this more seriously? I mean, that they have more tools, more training to be able to assess the situation and then deal with it?
Absolutely. We have a lot of training, and we're always looking to improve. I'm on the Domestic Violence Law Enforcement Committee with many other agencies within the city that deal with domestic violence. And we're always looking to improve our policies, but we certainly do have very effective and efficient policies, and we just make sure officers are utilizing them.
Janine, we've been talking a little bit about some of the statistics and the numbers of calls that come into the Philadelphia Police Department. Do you feel like we are making progress in understanding the complexity of domestic violence and dealing with it and reducing its impact, not just on the partners, but I'm also thinking about the children that could be involved or be witnesses to some of this stuff?
You know, certainly Philadelphia is doing things now that are leading the way internationally.
Is that
I have
right?
not seen such a comprehensive response. You know, they've really taken a hold of that. Women Against Abuse was one of the leaders in creating that. And what we're so excited about is Mayor Kenney recently appointed a director of domestic violence strategies that will look at all health and human service protocols and help to make internal changes, yeah. which, you know, is just another thing. This is a very complex issue for reasons that we've talked about, and we are gaining a lot of ground, and we have a long way to go, but we believe that we can really reduce domestic violence in the city. And when you talk, 1 in 3 women in their lifetime will experience serious physical abuse. Imagine the children involved in that. When you're talking about poor areas like Philadelphia, that number goes up, okay? So if we think about it, we could be talking about half or more of our population is experiencing the impact of domestic violence. What does that tell you?
Yeah.
If we want to get a handle on the health and the safety in our community, this is the issue we need to be looking at.
That's such a powerful thing. Renee, looks like you want to add something.
Yeah, I did. I mean, we are definitely making progress. I was one of the first people to get a domestic violence protection from abuse order in the 70s.
Really?
And at that time, I had one. I called the police, and I was physically assaulted by my husband with a police officer that was standing 3 feet away. So things have definitely changed. Things have changed, and it's encouraging to me to see the change. And one of the things is that domestic violence is not something that's readily talked about.
Yeah.
It's so I appreciate opportunities like today to be able to discuss it. It needs to come out of the closet. A couple years ago, the whole incident with Ray Rice in the NFL, that was a blessing and a curse because a lot of people said the same thing I said. Oh, my God, I've not heard the word domestic violence so much over the course of a couple of months on radio, television, on the bus, in the supermarket. People were discussing it. There was a lot of misinformation out there, but whenever you bring something to the forefront that's been behind closed doors for so long, it's an opportunity to educate. So I can say, well, the Philadelphia police didn't help me in that one incident and one night in 1976. But that doesn't mean that I was not supported along the way. So it's important not to bring judgment on this happened in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And after all, we're all people. You know, we're all people, and it's important for victims to know that anything can happen. But you are valuable. Reach out to a hotline. Talk to the hotline. It's confidential, and it can help start that conversation with someone, so it's not just you going through it. And there are wonderful resources out there.
And what I hear you say also, Renee, is this, it takes time. I mean, it takes sort of some deep soul searching, obviously. Some, as you say, you've been in therapy for years now.
Yes.
This happened decades ago.
Yes, decades ago. And it still colors my life. But I have to say that I started with Women Against Abuse and Returning the Favor. Women Against Abuse in 1979 got me to a shelter when they were just thebaby.org. They got me to a shelter in Texas, 1,600 miles away, to another baby.org, the shelter there. So I volunteered in Texas. I volunteered in Philadelphia. And initially it started off as Returning the Favor because they did save my life. And now it's just become my life's work.
Let me read an email from Chip. He says, how can men be allies to women? Should we confront men, call authorities, suggest help? How does this happen without putting women in danger?
Actually, and those are great ideas.
Yes.
I agree with all of those, you know, not to take a stand, to speak out, not to just watch it and let it go. But obviously, you don't want to confront if it's a dangerous situation. Best to just call 911 if you're witnessing something.
An email from Syed says, my wife and I are getting threats from someone whose advances she previously rejected because she was never in a relationship with him. The protection from abuse doesn't apply for her. I've been told there are no other options for us in Pennsylvania. What can we do to protect ourselves and our family? This is all I have for you, Krista, but what are your thoughts?
Yes. Obviously, it's a bit of limited information, but I would say that if this person is continuing to harass, it sounds like stalking. Wow. So I would continue to have police reports and make sure that they get with an advocacy group, but also continue to call 911 and the offender could be arrested for a charge such as terroristic threats or stalking.
And then there's stay-away orders.
Absolutely.
That they would be able to get. It wouldn't be a protection from abuse order, but it would be a stay-away order.
Yeah, you can
order.
Get a stay-away order in court that would be judge-specific, but would also act as an order to keep that person away.
We did a show a couple of months ago about this link between terrorism and domestic violence, something I hadn't actually thought about, but Omar Mateen in Orlando apparently had been abusing his wife, and we, of course, know what he did there. Can you speak to that? We're almost out of time, Janine.
I can quickly. And, you know, these links are now coming out with so much research on violence in the home and violence in the community and with all the mass killings, that a lot of those folks either had the mass killings were part of a domestic violence incident. They killed their partner, a lot of family members, or they just have a history of domestic violence. So we need to ask ourselves. Recently, I heard Gloria Steinem speak about domestic violence as the original violence. And if we think about that with the mass shootings and violence in our community, if we want to get at it, we have to do it in the families of origin, in the home, in those relationships.
I know you want to say something, Renee, but we are out of time. And my thanks to all three of you for joining us today on Radio Times, especially to you, Renee Norris-Jones, for telling us some of your story and talking about the work that's being done. I appreciate it so much.
It was my pleasure.
You're welcome. Renee Norris-Jones, a domestic abuse survivor. She's an advocate, a board member of Women Against Abuse. Janine Lisitsky, thank you for coming back on Radio Times.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Executive Director of Women Against Abuse. And Krista Dahl Campbell, Lieutenant for the Victim Services Unit and Community Relations for the Philadelphia Police Department. Thank you for coming in as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moskowain. Thanks for joining us.